Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Let's hear some inside now on President Trump's first speech to Congress last night and hear your ideas and reflections as well. Here's the president.
Dying industries will come roaring back to life. Heroic veterans will get the care they so desperately need. Our military will be given the resources its brave warriors so richly deserve. Crumbling infrastructure will be replaced with new roads, bridges, tunnels, airports, and railways gleaming across our very, very beautiful land.
We're turning now to an economist and the president of the American Action Forum, Douglas Holtz Aiken. Doug, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me on.
And if you watched or listened to President Trump's speech last night, is there a particular item that concerns you? Are you pleased about some of the priorities that you heard President Trump talking about last night? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Ideas that he talked about last night that concern you or that you are happy that he is prioritizing, on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Doug, presidents usually have a pretty large audience for their first speeches to Congress. Is the audience as much members of Congress as it is the American people for this one?
I thought this was very much aimed at the American people, and it felt very much like a reboot of the inauguration speech, you know, something with a tone closer to presidential, something that was less biting than his typical rally and as the inauguration speech was. This was a different presentation of essentially the same ideas.
And that's a good point, although you did hear him going into more detail about some of his budget priorities. What stands out for you besides the military spending? And I want to talk about that in a second.
Honestly, what surprised me was that I went into the speech with really two things I was looking for. Number one, on the foreign policy front, what was his vision for America's place in the world? How would he address countries like China, with whom we have some problematic relations? Is that a military engagement, a diplomatic and military, economic, diplomatic, you know, things like that? I didn't walk away with a great feel on that front. But the thing I really thought we'd find out is, of the long list of things that he's interested in, you know, $1 trillion in infrastructure, building a wall, tax reform, repeal and replace Obamacare, Supreme Court justice, all of these things, which are the ones that are at the top of the list? What does he want Congress to do and do now? And instead of doing that, he added to the list. Now we're going to do paid family leave and comprehensive immigration reform. I thought it was really quite stunning.
I guess I get the sense that the infrastructure is near the top of that list. He talked about it a lot during the campaign. He spent quite a bit of time on that last night among the whole list of other things. How does that get paid for, by the way?
Well, I'm going to agree with you. I thought of the things he talked about on the campaign, border security and infrastructure were the two that jumped out to me. But we still have yet to see a single piece of paper out of the White House on what exactly he wants from Congress. And he certainly has no idea of exactly how to pay for this. And it's not really clear to me yet how much he's actually asking for. On the campaign, he talked about getting $1 trillion of infrastructure, but it only had $180 billion of taxpayer money. The rest was supposed to be offered up by the private sector.
Right.
We'll see. I've yet to see a plan on how he gets that.
I just want to ask you something else on that, because we've done a number of shows on this. When I hear public-private partnership, I think about things that have been done in this state and others where companies come in and build it, and then they make the revenue back on toll, you know, roads or something like that. Is that what he means, or is it a much larger concept here that I'm missing?
I don't think you're missing anything. In the end, what he proposed was to have tax credits supplement the return to private investors and make them interested in making equity investments in infrastructure. That's only possible if there's some cash flow to begin with, right? You have to have some way to repay the equity investment, so
right.
You have to have a toll or a fee or something. And quite frankly, there are a lot of public-private partnerships, but they're often on the debt side. The private sector buys some debt. We don't usually have the private sector owning the infrastructure. And for some things, you know, I'm in Washington, D.C., the Memorial Bridge is a National Historic Landmark. It needs repaired. It's hard to imagine turning that over to the private sector and saying, you get to own this now. So I'm not sure this fits all our problems.
Call here for you, Doug, from Peter in St. Paul. Hi, good morning, Peter. What'd you hear last night that stood out for you?
So some of the references about the health care, again, the devil's in the details. And it seems like they released some of the details outside of the speech. But I kind of like the I'm not a big fan of Trump, but I do like the buying insurance across state boundaries. And I actually, from an economics point of view, like the idea of taxing health insurance benefits at work and using those funds to cover more. I think the biggest failure with the Affordable Health Care Act was patronizing the health insurance industry. And it was almost like an agricultural subsidy. It doesn't go to the farmers. It goes to the agricultural companies. And I thought that was the biggest failure. As much as UHC is great for our local economy, I don't think those guys do anything for the economy at large.
Peter, I'm really glad you brought up that piece about selling insurance across state lines. Doug, what are the implications of that?
I think in 2017, they're not as big as some people might hope. One of the things that has happened in the healthcare sector is that the sharp division between an insurance company, which handled financial risk and, you know, collected money and got healthy people and poor people and shifted the risks across them, and providers who actually delivered healthcare services, that sharp distinction is disappearing. Many insurers, United, he mentioned, have their own networks of providers. And you can't really sell a policy across state lines if there isn't a network of providers that that insurance company works with across those state lines. So I think the capacity to do it can't be harmful, but I'm not sure it'll actually change the competitive structure as much as some might hope.
Yeah, Peter also mentioned the taxing of the health care benefits. You worked for John McCain's campaign. Do I remember this right, that John McCain suggested that, right?
Yes. And in response, Barack Obama ran an ad with a ball of twine unraveling, and the text said, John McCain will tax your health insurance for the first time. And Glenn Kessler, who runs the fact check over at the Washington Post, told me not long ago that it remains the single most run political ad ever.
Is that
right?
I confess
having PTSD. I can't watch it. And I think the lesson there is that the politics of that are still very tough. There isn't a conservative health policy expert who doesn't say, hey, we shouldn't do this. A large open-ended subsidy to health insurance for the most affluent Americans really doesn't make a lot of sense. But actually getting it done is going to be hard. And I endorse the idea, but I'll believe it when I actually see someone vote on it in Congress.
Here's something else. I've been in conversation recently with a number of health professionals and health policy experts about the economics of the ACA. One of the things that they say is that no matter how you the parameters of fixing the ACA where they are now does not really address the increasing cost of health care itself. Would you agree with that?
I think the big failure of the ACA was to focus too much on coverage expansions and not enough on so-called bending the cost curve. So I do think that's right. I think Republicans, generally speaking, have always felt the best way to address the cost of health care was through the payments in the big entitlement programs, the Medicares and Medicaids. The president ran saying we're not going to do Medicare reform. And so he's taken off the table one of the ways they thought they could change the incentives in the healthcare sector, get higher quality care at lower costs. And I think that's going to be hard as a result to do that effectively in this repeal and replace effort.
When you hear about the details of this Medicaid expansion and how the GOP plan, which it now sounds like President Trump supports, changes and cuts back on Medicaid grants, does that mean that there are people who are getting health insurance now who will not have it?
It doesn't necessarily mean that. I think the model for this in the eyes of most of the folks on Capitol Hill are places like Wisconsin or Indiana who went to the Obama administration and said, okay, we are going to reform our Medicaid program. We'd like a waiver from the standard rules. We're going to have our Healthy Indiana plan or our Badger plan. And they expanded coverage with that, and the folks on Capitol Hill looked at those models and think they can do more with less money if they give them the flexibility that those governors were given. And I expect an important part of whatever emerges from this effort will be the efforts of new HHS Secretary Tom Price to grant Medicaid waivers and other relaxation of the standard rules to allow people to innovate a little bit.
Nicole says on Twitter, he keeps hitting his one-line bullet points but never has any details. He also never mentions how to pay for the things that he wants. Call here from Bill in Roseville. Hi, Bill. What are you curious about?
I'm curious about, Trump talks about these crazy wars that we're in and all the money that's being wasted and how we could put it back into this country. And yet there doesn't seem to be any interest in getting us out of any of these ridiculous wars that we should have never gotten into. Are we going to be in wars forever? I mean, what's going on?
What did you hear, Doug, on that part? And then we'll talk about the military spending he wants to do.
As I mentioned at the outset, I was curious what he felt was, America's role in the world. And there have been presidents who basically enunciated a vision where the U.S. was the world's cop and was on the beat to enforce good behavior. And that certainly has never seemed like where he is, but I don't really know where he is. Having said that, he's promising to, plow $54 billion more into the military and committed to giving our troops everything they would need to be ready for presumably active combat missions. And so it's a bit of a puzzle.
Here's what he said specifically to increasing the military budget.
Finally, to keep America safe, we must provide the men and women of the United States military with the tools they need to prevent war. If they must, they have to fight, and they only have to win. I am sending Congress a budget that rebuilds the military, eliminates the defense sequester, and calls for one of the largest increases in national defense spending in American history.
Okay, Doug, a couple questions about this. The sequester limited spending, what happens if he removes that?
He can't remove that. He will have to get Congress to change the Budget Control Act. So
Okay. That's
something that's going to require the cooperation of Democrats in the Senate to get to 60 votes and get it done. So that's an important hurdle. It should be noted in terms of just the numbers. While he's talking about raising it $54 billion, that's essentially the same amount that would come from just removing the cap and going back to the old line. It turns out that President Obama regularly requested amounts that were above the cap and begged Congress to figure it out. So he's really only about 3% above where Obama kept requesting. It's not as big as it might sound. It would bring military spending to about $600 billion. And there are those in the House, Mac Thorngrave, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, thinks maybe $640 billion would be a better number. So they're a long way apart on both what the right number is and how to get there.
Actually, though, that's really good perspective because it sounds like a huge number until we have the context that you just gave us. Here's the other thing that he says, and I think he said this in an interview with Fox ahead of the speech, that if he can bring GDP growth up to, I think he was saying, around 3%, he said that it was at about 1%. Aren't we at about 1.9% right now?
We're at about 1.9 now, and ballpark, we've been chugging along at 2 for many years.
Okay, so do you raise enough revenue to pay for a lot of this stuff that he has specifically not put hard numbers up against?
Again, what he inherited before he started doing anything on his own is a deficit of $9 trillion over the next 10 years. If you were to raise GDP growth by a full percentage point, which is an enormous increase, let's just stipulate that. So everything breaks away, you get up one full percentage point, you will raise about $2.7 trillion in additional budget room over the next 10 years. So you don't even take care of the big problem, and now he's starting to add things. I don't believe that $54 billion is a one-time thing. If you're getting rid of the cap this year, well, won't you get rid of it next year? So you're really looking at maybe 10 years of $54 billion. That's half a trillion, and it quickly adds up. So I'm a big fan of having better economic growth. We have not done as well as I believe we should. I think there are good things they can do policy-wise to improve that. It'll be hard to get to 3, and if you do, you won't solve all your problems magically.
I want to not miss something that you said at the very beginning here, which is that he is not only investing more in what we already have, he's adding things like family leave.
Yeah.
That's no small budget item, is it?
Correct. That's a again, a big new entitlement. I'm sure there were many on the Republican side of the aisle last night who swallowed harder when they heard that. I'm sure the Democrats were cheered. They didn't have lots of moments of cheer, but that's something that both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton campaigned on, and I think they would love to see him go forward with.
I really appreciate the experience and the context here. Doug, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Doug Holzhagen is an economist and president of the American Action Forum, weighing in with us this morning, Steph Curtis, about and really giving me some valuable information as I go forward and have conversations about the president's budget. I was not aware of those specific numbers about military spending, and so he's giving me good information that I can use. I hope he's giving you great information that you can use as well as a member of Minnesota Public Radio or a potential member.